right? You were saying that the more money Westinghouse wasted, the more money they made.
Yeah, that's what happens on a cost plus percentage fee contract. I might add that the government, when it gives out one of these contracts, they're on a fixed fee basis. You get so much, and if you lose money on it, that's your hard luck. Anyway, RCA said we can't live this way, so they went out. At that time, Victor was practically out of business. The old Victor company that made those Victor phonographs, those old mechanical phonographs, was practically out of business because, you know, you could get better music right in your home with a radio set. So they went out and they bought the Victor company. They bought the Victor building in Camden. And they set up the RCA as a manufacturing company, RCA Victor, in Camden. And General Electric and Westinghouse divested themselves of the radio and talking movie business and turned it over to RCA together with all the patents. I think there were some 7,000 patents. Turned that all over. AT&T and Bell Labs were also involved. They had given rights to the General Electric and Westinghouse. They turned all that over to RCA together with the departments. The radio department went to Camden. Westinghouse and General Electric, they went to Camden. And when I was employed, hired by a manager named Lewis Worthington Shubb, he went to Camden as assistant manager, and there was a man named W.R.G. Baker who headed the radio department at General Electric, and he went to Camden. Everybody went to Camden. And at that time, I was living here in Pittsburgh, and the patent department asked me if I wanted to come over and be a patent attorney, and I elected to do that. I might add about this deal, which set up the RCA as a manufacturing organization, a few things that I know about. What they did, they turned over all their patents to RCA in the radio and talking movie field. And in return, RCA split its stock to begin with and gave Westinghouse 3 million shares and General Electric 4 million shares. And that's 7 million shares. And I can still remember the total number of shares that there was altogether. It was 13,880,000. And you can see that RCA and that Westinghouse and General Electric had control of RCA. Now, this was during Hoover's administration. And Hoover had an attorney general whose name was Mitchell, and he said, this will never do. You can't have control. So they entered into an agreement. It was called the A1 agreement, under which the manufacturing companies got some of their rights back in the patents so they could make radio sets if they wanted to. And they had to divest themselves of that 7 million shares. So at that time, this was about in 1934, if you had Westinghouse stock, you'd get a stock dividend of RCA stock, or if you had GE stock, you'd get a stock dividend of GE stock. They had to get out. And they set up something called, as I say, the A1 agreement, under which they got some rights back in the radio field. And they paid royalty, and as it happened, I administered the A1 agreement until it ran out in 1954. Now, I went over to the patent department, and the way we operated, I would work in the patent department as an agent, I guess you'd call it, patent agent, and went to law school. We got off at about 4:20 every day and went to night school at Duquesne 5 nights a week. I saw Eugene's, this was during the Depression, see, I saw Eugene Strasburger, the old Eugene Strasburger, who was a teacher down there, about a year or two before he died, and he told me that at that time, the school didn't have the money to pay them, and they worked as teachers for nothing at the at Duquesne Law School. Well, I graduated from Duquesne in 1934 and took the bar examinations and passed the bar examinations. And that's when I started to practice, was in 1934. Most of the practice was at Westinghouse. Most of it was soliciting patents. I say I administered the A1 agreement. My work was predominantly in the radio and related electronics fields. And I worked there until 1942, when I was commissioned in the Navy as a full lieutenant. Here's a picture of me, I guess, if you're interested.
Baby face.
Yeah, that's the way I always was. I'll tell you an interesting story about that. I was assigned as a design officer to the Bureau of Ships, to the design section of the Bureau of Ships. Hyman Rickover was there. He was on circuit breakers. And I was on what they called IFF, Identification Friend or Foe, when a craft, an aircraft or a ship picks up on its radar a target of some kind, they have to know whether it's a friendly target or it's an enemy target. So what we had, we called that IFF, Identification Friend or Foe. And what I worked on was these equipments that they used. What they used to do, they used to have something called an interrogator responder on each craft and a transponder on each craft. And what the interrogator responder would, the responder would send out a signal and would interrogate the transponder on the other craft. And if the signal came back, then they knew it was a friendly craft. And so I worked on that all during the war. Now, what I did was I supervised the operations of some of the operations at Hazeltine Corporation, which had been started as a result of Louis Hazeltine's work, and also at Farnsworth in Fort Wayne. And, you know, we were fighting a war, so I didn't show too much mercy. And I was told that one of the vice presidents of Farnsworth was sitting on in a club car traveling somewhere with a highball in his lap, and he made this statement that Lieutenant Diamond has a baby face, but he can be a son of a bitch. I remember we scrapped a whole warehouse full of transformers. I got out of the Navy in 1946 and went back to Westinghouse, where I worked and still work. I write a lot of patent applications for Westinghouse, and I do general law work. And I still do all that. I was married in 1950, and I have two children. I say my son graduated from high school 50 years after I did, and that's because I was married late in life. My son is a lawyer for Chicago Title, and my daughter works at getting people off the workman compensation rolls.
Is she a social worker?
What's that?
Is she a social worker?
No. What she does is she works for some outfit that works for the insurance companies. She goes to these people who are on workman's compensation and interviews them, and try to determine if they're phonies to begin with. And then she goes out and tries to find jobs for them. They try to place them. If they refuse to be placed, then they take their workman's compensation away from them. If my son had stayed in the general law business, they'd been on opposite sides.
Where is she working?
Out of Carnegie.
Oh.
I mentioned that I had two sisters, but I think this picture was taken when only one of the sisters was born. This is me, and this is my my sister Eva Rubin. I think that's Eva Rubin. This is my deceased sister Lena, my mother.
Now Lena came to the United States with you, and the other two girls were born after you arrived.
Yeah, Lena came here. She was she married Dr. Eisner. I don't know whether you know them or not. Jean Klein is her son-in-law. And Eisner, Milton, Miffy Eisner, I think he's the president of the shul down there. And that was she had three children, Milton, Bainey, and Ruth Ann. Ruth Ann is married to Gene Klein. Milton is the president of the shul. He has two sons, and Bainey works for Xerox. He has two daughters.
Are your children married?
No. I don't think they ever will be married.
How did you meet your wife?
What's that?
How did you meet your wife?
Well, my sister Lena was bought stuff from what the heck is the name of that outfit down there? Anyway, Dave Friedman, if you know him, he's my brother-in-law. Anyway, they told me, they arranged for me to have a date with Lois sometime in the late 40s, and that developed out of that date. We were married in June of 1950.
Did your wife work?
She was a school teacher, but she quit work as soon as, before we were married.
You mentioned that as far as your mother was concerned, you were the only child. What did your sisters do? Did they go to high school also?
My sister Lena just went to high school. And my sister Eva just went to high school. My sister Lil went to Carnegie Tech. By that time, I think my father had reached the stage where he thought a girl ought to get an education, too.
What did she take at Tech?
Secretarial. She died in 1970. I think she took secretarial. Here is a picture of me and the other group in the United States Navy when I think it was more or less at the end of the war.
Were you friendly with Admiral Rickover when you were working?
No, I knew him, but I wasn't. He wasn't a guy you could be very friendly with. I remember one time being on a plane coming back, not so many years ago, coming back from Washington. And I was sitting, and he came over and he says, "You're in my seat." And I looked at my ticket, and I was in the right seat. The problem was that he had the seat in front of me, but he never apologized or anything else. He was a very hard-boiled guy. He had when they were working on the nuclear reactor down at Bettis, incidentally, that Bettis is a government facility operated by Westinghouse, and he supervised it. And there was a fellow named Shop, who was the head of it, who had a heart condition, and he wasn't too good shape. So Rickover blew into town one night, called up and said he wanted to see Shep, and Shep's wife, Catherine, said, "Well, you can't see him because he's sick in bed." And he says, "I have to see him," and he insisted and everything else, and it ended up by Catherine and Shep saying to him, "You can go right to hell," or something like that. Shep has since died. This is a picture of our class. I think it's a 50th anniversary out of Carnegie Tech.
Yes.
There aren't so many of us left. I think Dave Scheinman is on that. This is the 1979. My wife saves all these things.
Well, that's good. I like the way she puts arrows, too, to make certain everybody knows.
Yeah, I didn't know where they were, but she found them.
Oh, sure, here's Grace Shine.
Yeah, that's Dave's gone. He's gone, too.
Westinghouse has always been liberal toward the Jewish employee, haven't they?
Well, as I say, my earliest experience was that, they told me they weren't hiring until Slepian tore that guy apart. And then when I got in there, I found they were hiring right and left.
Oh.
They even hired one fellow who said he came out of Ohio State. He graduated. And only a few days after he was hired, they discovered he was a phony. But they still kept him. He went and asked, I don't know what this will signify to you, but he asked somebody how many volts in an ampere. Volts and amperes are different things. But they were hiring. Now, I'll tell you one more thing. In about 1948, something happened. 1948 or 49, we got a new boss. They fired the old boss, and we got a new boss named Steiger. And when he got in, the first thing he did was fire two very competent Jewish attorneys. Always It always intrigues me to hear them talk about how they want merit when it comes to affirmative action. And they were very competent, the most competent men in the department. One of them was Al Shapiro, who practices law downtown. The other was a fellow named Bernie Zangwill, who was deceased now. But he was a good man. And later on, they fired a Jewish fellow named Kurt Avery. Kurt had been, his name was Abraham. He'd been a patent agent in Germany, worked for for Siemens Schuckerbecker. And when things got about pretty hot in Germany in 1936, he decided to come here. His boss was a 1923 Nazi named Wiegand, and urged him to stay. You know, if you know somebody personally, it isn't you're not so mad at him if he happens to be Jewish or something like that. Racism and anti-Semitism are abstract affects. But he didn't. He came here and he worked. They told him he got signals to change his name to Avery, and he worked for a firm which, after they put an embargo on anything from Germany, went out of business. So I helped him get into Westinghouse, and they laid him off too. And he was an extremely competent man. Now I learned afterwards that what had happened was that the other attorneys had decided at that time that they had too many Jews. Sometimes I suspect that they would have fired me too, only at that time they got sued by an outfit named Siaki in resistance welding, and I was an expert in that area, so they couldn't fire me. Siaki happened to be a Jewish outfit that had a very wealthy outfit that had been in France and come here to the United States and set up a company when the Nazis got in. But they sued us under a patent. Some of those attorneys there said they didn't like too many Jews in the department, so they laid off Jews. This couldn't happen now under the civil rights law. They would take an awful beating. And they wouldn't do it now. They're fairly liberal with Jews now. Westinghouse is a good company to work for. Their treatment of employees is pretty good. Wasn't so good during the Depression, but they had people there who had worked for years and had suddenly been set afloat, laid off.
Well, Joe Slepian was Jewish, right?
Yeah.
When you came to work, and he was instrumental, do you remember about how many other Jewish workers there were?
Well, I don't know. I didn't get... There were some Jewish workers. There was a fellow named Morris who lived down there who changed the lights. And there was Slepian. And there was a fellow, a classmate of mine from Harvard named Morris Stone, who afterwards became... They laid him off in 1934. He afterwards became a vice president of United Engineering. Now, the way Joe started to work there, he went to teach, I think, at Cornell he taught for about a year and decided he wanted a different kind of work, so he went to work for Westinghouse for a quarter an hour. That's what the standard pay was there in the early teens. And he was a pretty good at scientific work, so he worked his way up. And then one thing that happened, he asked for an increase in pay, and the local management wouldn't give him, so he quit. And he went to some meeting, of the engineering people and ran into a vice president of Westinghouse who was surprised to find out he wasn't working for Westinghouse anymore. By that time, he'd attained some stature. And he went back and told that guy to go hire him, and Joe wrote about his own ticket. I don't know whether you remember I.L. Giffen, but I.L. Giffen wrote the agreement for Joe Sleppy. And he helped me get in there. He didn't stand for any nonsense. I don't know of anything that might be particularly interesting beyond that.
Well, Westinghouse changed a good deal from the time you started to work there.
Oh, I'll say it's changed. I get depressed when I go down to East Pittsburgh. You know, that used to be, that's where I started to work. And that's where I worked until about 1964, and it was a bustling city. The plant was working. Now the plant isn't working, and it's practically dead. It really is depressing to look at Westinghouse. Now, they're spread all over. East Pittsburgh isn't of any importance anymore. They're getting out of those kind of businesses anyway. East Pittsburgh made big machinery. General Electric stayed at Schenectady. It's still there.
What types of work did you were working in the beginning, as you said, with
talking movies.
I
was assigned to the design of home talking moving machines.
And then when that went to Schenectady,
it went to Camden.
You went into the patent. Now, how did business change? It started out with an emphasis on.
I kept on working on the patents.
Uh-huh.
In the talking movie field.
I see.
And related patents, and then worked into the electronics field. I've since worked, my work right now is in the nuclear field, most of it.
Now, did you have to go back for additional schooling in nuclear?
No. You get pretty thorough schooling as a physicist, at least in my time you did. No, I didn't get any. The only schooling I had was in law.
I am aware that Westinghouse had, at one time, perhaps they still do, had a good many Israeli personnel.
Well, I didn't run into any, but I do know that some of the radar equipment that they made, I used to work with Baltimore on radar equipment, was for Israel. I saw that in the files. Aside from that, I don't remember running into any Israelis.
Perhaps they were in a different division. What about high up in the executive? I know there was one executive.
There was one Jewish fellow in the executive. I forgot what his name was.
Cy Herwald.
Yeah, Herwald.
Mm-hmm. Anybody else? And
I think Krasick was a vice president before he died. Sid Krasick. Now, Zalman Shapiro left Westinghouse and he organized NUMEC. I did a lot of work for NUMEC. And then they sold NUMEC to Atlantic Richfield. And, for a long time, I continued to work for Atlantic Richfield. And Zalman went back to Westinghouse. I think by now he must be retired. I haven't seen him, I haven't talked to him for a long time. But I guess there are managers and who are Jewish, but I can't think of any. I think there's no bias there anymore. And of course, you know what happened in the 1948 can't happen again, under the civil rights law.
Now, did you officially retire, or?
Oh, yeah.
You did. In what year?
At that time, 1966. I got to be 65 years of age. At that time, you had to retire at the age of 75. You don't have to at the age of 65. You don't have to now under the law.
But you kept working as a consultant, and I can see you're still very busy.
Yeah, I kept working as a consultant all the time. I took a vacation. We went up to, took the kids up to Canada where we'd gone to our honeymoon, and then came back and went back to work.
How many days a week are you devoting to consulting?
Whatever it takes. See, the way I work is, if I feel like working, I work, and if I don't, I don't work, and it doesn't matter whether it's Saturday or Sunday or a weekday or an evening. I just continue to work. I do some general work. My niece's husband has 54 stores and malls, and I've gone over every lease, big leases. So that's what I do.
Do you do any outside work
besides
family that you did for your niece's
husband?
So you're not only working for Westinghouse, you're working for